Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Benzion Kravitz, the founder and head of Jews for Judaism, an important organization that works to counteract cults and missionaries who target young Jews. He's the winner of the 2011 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for service to Klal Yisrael, the people of Israel. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I've had the privilege of spending a little time in the mountains the last couple of weeks, mostly skiing on what snow there is this season. I don't know if it's a consequence of global warming or just the chance effect of a historically dry winter. After all, last year was a record-setting winter the other way, with tremendous snowfall all over the mountains of the West. But whether caused by the vagaries of meteorology or divine disfavor or fossil fuel emissions, there is not very much snow in the Rockies or the Sierra Nevada mountains this winter. And as an enthusiastic and long-term skier, that makes for less than challenging slopes and disappointing downhills, with many of the best runs closed for lack of snow. But in a way, it doesn't matter. Time spent in the beauty of the winter mountains is time well spent, and we Jews have been finding inspiration and God in the mountains for a very long time. After all, it was on Mount Moriah that God stopped Abraham from sacrificing his son, and on Mount Sinai where we received the Ten Commandments. When King David sang, "I lift up my eyes to the mountains where my help originates," in Psalm 121, Shir HaMa'alot, literally a song of ascents, well, it's only one of 15 in the Psalms, King David was simply confirming what many Jews have always felt. Going up higher somehow moves us closer to God. In fact, Mount Zion, across from Jerusalem, became a place so holy it represented all of Judaism. Mountains are special, and a place of both beauty and holiness. It is no wonder that our Jerusalem sanctuary was built on the Temple Mount, Har HaBait, still the most sacred site in the world for Jews, flanked as it is by the Kotel, the Western Wall. Mountains matter to us, and journeying to them helps refresh the soul. I don't think our ancestors found divine inspiration speeding down a steep, snow-packed run on skis, with the cold wind in their faces and the heart-pounding experience of nearly flying while still on the ground, but I am sure they found their spirits lifted when they left their cities and towns and looked up and journeyed up to the heights. So I've returned this week inspired and elevated. Pun sort of intended. We all need this kind of lift, whether we get it literally riding a ski lift or whether just journeying out and up does it for us all by itself. It reminds us that we have the God-given capacity to appreciate the magnificence of our natural world, the soaring snow-capped mountains especially, and to find inspiration there. And so to play us in on our mountainous theme this fine morning, here's a setting of Psalm 121, Shir HaMa'alot, Essa Einai, in a contemporary production of Yosef Karduner's setting, with a bit of Coldplay mixed in by Nirel Gamliel. Trust me, it works.
Esa enai ele harim, me'ain yavo ezri, ezri me'im Hashem, ose shamayim varetz, al iten lamot raglecha. Hine lo yanu. Yeah.
That was Shir Lema'alot, a song of ascents. May your souls be lifted up this morning as mine was in the higher elevations. As Psalm 121 concludes, may God guard your going out and your coming in, whether you're journeying high in the mountains or simply going out into the street. And may God bring you inspiration and clarity. Our guest this morning, Rabbi Ben-Zion Kravitz, is the founder of Jews for Judaism and the winner of the 2011 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for Service to the Jewish People. He has worked steadfastly to counteract the work of cults and missionaries who target young Jews. Find out what that means and how he does it when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the Family Size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guest, Rabbi Ben-Zion Kravitz. He is an authority on Judaism and Christian polemics, and most importantly, the founder of Jews for Judaism International, the executive director of the Los Angeles branch of Jews for Judaism. He has appeared on television and radio and written and lectured extensively throughout the United States, really all around the world, Soviet Union, South Africa, Australia, Canada, Britain, and Israel. His programs have been received by Jews and others of all denominations for more than 25 years, and he's an expert particularly on cults and missionary groups. Good morning. Welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Should also note that in the interest of full disclosure, Rabbi Kravitz is the winner of the 2011 Kohan Foundation Award for Service to Klal Yisrael. Mazel tov.
Thank you. I'm very honored.
Tell us all what Jews for Judaism is, how it started, why you do what you do.
We started Jews for Judaism 25 years ago as a direct response to families who were calling in crisis because their children were being deceptively converted to Christianity by a missionary group called Jews for Jesus. Therefore, you have the name of our organization, Jews for Judaism. In those days, it was a great, perfect name. It just really clicked for everyone. You know, if you don't like them, you'll love us. And over the years, we've developed a variety of educational programs and counseling that enable people to make critical thinking choices so that they can reevaluate what they've done and to re-explore the beauty of Judaism.
Now, cults have been an interesting challenge for Jews, problem really, for a long time. I particularly remember it from the late 60s and the early 70s and really on into the 80s. Tell us about how your work has involved working with Jews who have gone over to cults, what that means exactly, how that functions.
Well, I think, you know, that's very, very correct. Things have changed. Nothing stays stagnant. You know, in the early 60s, 70s, we would envision cults standing on street corners selling flowers for donations or chanting Hare Krishna in the airport, and that's not where we see it today. The internet has played a major part in the way cults and missionary groups are able to proselytize, because they can reach right into your house, your child's dormitory room, you know, without you even realizing what it is. So you have a variety of groups that are trying to manipulate people and get them to join their organizations. So just so primarily today, you know, you have cults like Scientology that, you know, are on the news all the time because of the celebrity involvement. The Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles has been called a cult by a number of experts. I always say if Madonna can wear a T-shirt that says cult member, who am I to disagree with her?
You know, we'll have to come back to that because it's a really interesting subject. We'll hear much more from Rabbi Ben-Zion Kravitz, founder of Jews for Judaism, winner of the 2011 Kohan Foundation Award, when we come back on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio at Yahoo, or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is set May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going on this fantastic journey to Israel, please email tojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, good morning.
So one of the issues that we've kicked around in the past has been how American Jews support Israel, how much criticism can be acceptable in the course of that support. Let's explore those issues today.
It's funny you should ask this today, because today we're actually in the beginning of a visit by Ethan Felsen. Ethan Felsen is the vice president of JCPA. He's also the person leading, in many ways, the new Israel Action Network initiative. And the Israel Action Network initiative comes to kind of try and handle exactly what you're talking about. What we did see along the several last years, I might say, is a growing phenomenon of criticism against Israel that many times crosses the line from criticism into demonization and delegitimization. And that brings an interesting question. How do you distinguish? How do you know who is speaking out of hate and is trying to present Israel as a place that shouldn't be? Or who is speaking out of love and disagree with one policy or the other, but wants to come and say, you know, I care about Israel. I bring criticism from a place of love, of caring, kind of hug and struggle, if you'd like. It's also interesting to see, how do you engage people today about Israel? How do you talk about Israel? An interesting study I read not long ago showed that when you're going to young adults, they no longer tend to agree with the concept of right and wrong, black and white. They see the world as more complex and more in shades of gray. And it seems that when you come to those young adults and you're not telling them, you know what, Israel is right, the Arabs are wrong, Israel is under threats and blah, 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 blah. But you're telling them, you know what, Israel is not perfect, but it is a decent and fair country. They find it much easier to agree with you and to support Israel. While if you come and say, Israel is right, is always right, and blah, 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 they push you away.
I think that's right. I think it's an important point that we who love Israel and support Israel so strongly sometimes forget, if we simply argue reflexively all of the terrible things going on in the Arab world or how awful the Palestinians are and talk about all the wonderful things in Israel, we turn off a large sector of our own young people who could love Israel but aren't going to believe fairy tales about it. They're only going to have an understanding for what a real terrific country is. Maybe that's where J Street is coming from.
J Street is coming, you know, I don't know exactly where they're coming from, but definitely they come with more significant criticism of Israel. Sometimes I must say that there are gaps between what their official spokesmen are saying and what their field people are saying. And sometimes it does seem that some of their criticism is crossing the line. While other times their criticism sounds very logic and very reasonable. I must admit, I would find that more appealing for me if I would hear them also sometimes saying good things about Israel and not all the time criticizing Israel, because that's kind of building credibility. You know, Israel relatively is good. Looking around, Israel is doing great stuff to the world and contributing a lot. It can't be that you only have bad things to say about Israel. It could be that you disagree with one thing or the other.
And, you know, if you're Jewish, you have to disagree sometimes.
Of course.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Bye.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom, and I guess we could still say Happy Secular New Year a week into the year.
Absolutely. Happy New Year, everybody.
You know, you got to keep that tolerance going. You were recently in Los Angeles at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Museum of Tolerance there, and it brings up an interesting question. For Jews, the Holocaust is such an important part. We need to teach people about the Holocaust, explain how something so spectacularly intolerant could have happened, how it could not happen again, but it can't really stop there.
Well, you raise a number of interesting questions. And this is going to probably require more than one show to deal with fully. But let me say that in the same trip, I went to Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Mendoza, Argentina. And let me say that in Mendoza, Argentina, the largest car dealership, which is this big glam building full of Toyotas and other things, is the Goldstein Toyota Agency. Now, Goldstein is a name with a particularly Jewish resonance, but in Argentina, a lot of Jewish names and German names are indistinguishable. And so you hear a name that could be Jewish, but it could also be some Nazi who fled and sought refuge in Argentina. And you think about these two populations who lived together in Germany in relative harmony. And in the first decades of the 20th century, Jews occupied cabinet-level posts. They were senior officers in the German military in World War I. Jewish money helped transform Germany from a largely agricultural country at the beginning of the 19th century to an industrial superpower by the end of the 19th century with railroads and autobahns and all kinds of things.
Yeah, actually, I mean, the head of production for Germany during World War I was Jewish.
Right. You know. Well, and many, many senior government officials and military officials and cultural figures. I mean, you know, you could... The list is endless. The point is that Jews assumed they lived in a rational, civilized, tolerant country, which is why so many of them ignored all the obvious signs of impending doom and just didn't leave when they could have left in 1932 or 33 or 34. It got much harder as the noose tightened. And, you know, one of the questions about which people always obsess in terms of the Holocaust is, why didn't they leave? Why didn't they see it coming? And I think part of the answer lies in their belief that their German friends and neighbors were so cultured and cultivated and civilized that they couldn't possibly descend to the level of intolerance that was personified by Hitler and by Hitler's overtly stated agenda. And they really didn't think they were in danger. So, I mean, for German Jews living in Germany in the late 20s and early 30s, there is definitely a close connection between the possibility of the Holocaust on the horizon and the level of tolerance they believed their fellow Germans had for them. Now, how that translates into tolerance education, the relationship between the Museum of Tolerance, as it's called, and the Simon Wiesenthal Center with which it's co-located, is an interesting and important question. And how you educate for tolerance,
it's a hard question,
other than showing what happens when there's an extreme lack of tolerance, which isn't necessarily the Shoah, the Holocaust, but it can be. I mean, these are important questions that I think we should devote at least one or two more broadcasts to.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe is out shopping when he meets his friend Abe outside the jewelry store. Moshe notices that Abe has a small gift wrap box in his hand. "Oh, what did you get, Abe?" Moshe asks. "Well, now that you've asked," replied Abe, "it's my Rivka's birthday tomorrow. And I asked her this morning what she wanted for her birthday. She said, 'Oh, I don't know, dear. Just give me something with a lot of diamonds.' 'So what'd you get her?' Moshe asks." And Abe replies, smiling, "I bought her a pack of cards." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. Don't try that with your wife. This week, we begin reading the book of Exodus with a spectacular Torah portion of Shemot. Shmot happens to be my favorite portion. Well, I mean, all Torah portions are my favorites, of course, but this one is maybe a little more favorite than the others because it's the portion I know best. I began studying it in earnest some 38 years ago in preparation for my bar mitzvah, and although I've been learning and teaching Torah for many years now, somehow Shmot remains closer to my heart than any other section. And in fact, it is a truly fabulous part of Torah, one of the best known and most vivid, filled with actions and situations that are central to our heritage. Shmot starts with the children of Israel going down to Egypt, completing the Joseph story begun in the last portions in Genesis. The great patriarch leads his whole family down to Egypt, where they settle. Joseph dies. His children and grandchildren and his brothers' children and grandchildren flourish, enjoying the patronage of the pharaonic regime that remembers Joseph's great service to Egypt. Suddenly, the regime changes. This should sound familiar to us today with the dramatic change in power in Egypt less than a year ago. The Israelites have grown in number and wealth, and the new pharaoh declares they are too many and too mighty for us. Rav ve'atsum mimenu. He proposes a solution. Enslave the Israelites, make them servants, deprive them of liberty and property. It is the first time that this is done to our people in human history, but sadly not the last. But God has a different plan. In spite of the persecution, the Israelites continue to grow in number, and the Pharaoh's paranoia grows. He decrees a more deadly final solution to the Jewish problem. Every boy baby is to be killed, eliminating the male of the species, destroying the Hebrews' very ability to reproduce. It is the 13th century BCE's version of ethnic cleansing. In this hostile environment, a Levite man marries a Levite woman, and they have a son. By kingly decree, he is supposed to be slaughtered at birth, or shortly thereafter, but two Egyptian midwives, Shifra and Puah, defy the Pharaoh's genocidal order and hide the boy baby, saving him from death. The young baby is saved and kept in his mother's care until his cries can no longer be kept from the Egyptian taskmasters. You know the rest of the story, I think. The boy is put into the famous waterproof basket and floated in the Nile. He is drawn from the water by the Pharaoh's own daughter, saved, named Moses, an Egyptian name, by the way, although the Torah tells us it came from the Hebrew for drawn from the water. He is given to his own sister Miriam and mother Yocheved to raise. And when Moses is a young man, he comes to the court as an Egyptian prince. The narrative in Shmot carries on with such dramatic intent that we cannot help but remember it. The young prince Moses sees an Egyptian taskmaster beat an Israelite slave. In a fit of youthful, righteous indignation, he kills the taskmaster and hides his body. His crime is discovered. He must flee to Midian, where he meets Zipporah at the well, is brought home, marries her, becomes a shepherd. He fathers two children, sees a miraculous burning bush, argues with God about taking on the task of freeing the Israelites, and eventually accepts his mission to free his people from slavery, becoming the model for all liberation leaders to come. Through his wife, Zipporah's actions, he survives a threat to his life on the way to Egypt and makes it back to the site of the great conflict to come. Still in Shmot, Moses' first efforts to free the children of Israel fail dismally, ending the narrative for this week. Wait till next Shabbos for much, much more. Well, there's also much more in this very portion of Shmot, way too much to really take in at once, but two points in particular stand out. The first is that the Torah takes great pains to tell us about the crucial role that women play in launching the career of our greatest leader and teacher, Moses. Without Shifra and Puah, the Egyptian midwives, Moses would have been killed at birth. Without the Pharaoh's daughter, he would have drowned in the Nile. Without his sister Miriam, he would have languished without knowledge of his origins. Later in Midian, without Zipporah, he would have died before returning to Egypt at all. There seems to be a concerted female effort to make sure that Moses survives to become the liberator and lawgiver of our people. Dayenu, we can say, it would have been enough to have one of these female saviors, but in Moses' case, he needed five or six. The second point is that Moses may be the least likely hero in human history. At the moment when God calls him to redeem his people from slavery, he is a fugitive hiding from a homicide rap, a stutterer who cannot successfully speak in public, a man with an uncontrollable temper, and a professional shepherd. He lacks all the prerequisites a vetting process would have required, except one. Moses is passionate about freedom and justice. Oh, and he has one more quality, if you can call it that. He is stubborn to a fault. Somehow, out of this unlikely mix of female saviors and personal failings comes the most important religious and political leader we have ever known. There are many messages in Shmote, but the striking one this time is that we all need help, often from the least likely sources. And each of us has the capacity to learn from our failures, and so rise to great heights. May we remember these lessons. We may not become Moses, but we can work to bring freedom and justice to our world. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Ben-Zion Kravitz, founder and president of Jews for Judaism and the winner of the 2011 Kohan Memorial Foundation Award for service to the Jewish people, will explain how he works with victims of cult recruitment and something about his methods for keeping young Jews Jewish. When we return in a few moments on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K through 12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The white supremacist arrested after informing his wife he planned to kill Jews and blacks may have targeted Anti-Defamation League leader Abe Foxman, the FBI said last week. Danny Lee Warner, 33 years old, was arrested December 28th outside a McDonald's in Lake Havasu, Arizona, the day after his estranged wife received a letter postmarked December 19th saying he planned to kill, let's say it nicely, African-Americans and Jews until the government stopped him. According to the police, Warner's wife and his internet browsing history suggest he also may have hoped to head to New York and target Abe Foxman, the ADL's national director and a recent guest of Two Jewish. The day that Warner was arrested, the ADL sent out a security alert to Jewish organizations warning us that we could potentially be targets. Photographs provided by the police showed Warner giving a Nazi salute. According to law enforcement, Warner has been a leader of the Silent Aryan Warriors, a white supremacist organization, while serving 10 years in a Utah prison. He was charged with violating parole, weapons infractions in Arizona, and possessing stolen property in California, as well as other unspecified federal charges. The cultural conflict between religious and secular Jews in Israel is not calming down much. Last week, a Haredi protest of what some of the ultra-Orthodox perceived to be secular persecution featured reenactments of a famous Holocaust photo from the Warsaw ghetto, this time with a young Haredi boy wearing a yellow star, pretending to be under attack from quote-unquote Zionists in the role of Nazis. Many Israelis, including cabinet ministers who are Holocaust survivors themselves, like Yossi Peled, reacted with shock and horror at the ultra-Orthodox provocation. And although you may not be aware of it, some buses that serve ultra-Orthodox Haredi areas of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv have created single-sex seating, men in front, of course, to protect the delicate sensibilities of the Haredi community. This has created significant tension among the majority Chiloni, the so-called secular community, which makes up more than 80% of Israeli society. In the news last week, the ultra-Orthodox Haredi man who is accused of sexually harassing IDF soldier Doron Matalon after she refused to sit in the back of a public bus in Jerusalem said that Matalon had intervened in an argument between him and another woman who stood near the men-only section of the bus. According to the Haredi guy, Shlomo Fuchs, Ms. Matalon acted provocatively. She stood amidst the ultra-Orthodox men. It's the most basic concept. A woman should not stand amidst men, just like no woman would go into a men's bathroom. So I called her a slut. Lovely. Fuchs said he was traveling from his home in the Neve Yaakov neighborhood to Yeshiva in Meir Shearim when some Russian women stood by the men's seats at the front of the bus. I told them, ladies, you don't have to present a ticket if you have a monthly pass. She said, thank you very much. Suddenly, I heard someone from the middle of the bus saying, she'll stand where she pleases. So I answered, what business is it of yours? I couldn't see who was speaking because the bus was full. I only heard her voice. I didn't see it was a soldier. I could only make out her head, and I yelled, slut. At this point, Fuchs claimed, Matalon said, look at you, parasite, parasites taking money from the state. I protect you. She protects me. I sit at shul from 8 in the morning till midnight and study, and she's protecting me. I protect her, the ultra-Orthodox man said. I understood who I was dealing with, so I went back to studying for my test, and things calmed down. Yeesh. Well, Mr. Fuchs, she does protect you and helps protect all Israelis, religious, reform, and secular. And she doesn't insist that you sit in the back of the bus, either.
Hooray for Hollywood, that phony super coney Hollywood.
In other news, our Hollywood Watch segment tells us that Israeli-born movie star Natalie Portman ended her latest visit to Israel last week after touring the Holy Land for 6 days. Portman was born in Jerusalem as Natalie Hirschlag. She arrived in the country accompanied by her fiancé, Benjamin Millepied, and her six-month-old son, Aleph. Aleph, of course, means A or one. One of the goals of the visit was to show off her new baby to her many relatives in Israel. In order to avoid the paparazzi in Israel, Portman hired two bodyguards to accompany her. She traveled in a large car with dark windows and even checked into the King David Hotel using a false name. This being Israel, where everyone soon knows everything about everybody, the cover must have lasted, oh, 2 or 3 minutes. Portman and her family arrived from France, where Millepied was born and raised. During their visit, they toured Jerusalem, her hometown, as well as going to the Dead Sea and Tel Aviv. Natalie Portman was often seen sitting in cafes in Jerusalem, where she kindly posed for photographs with fans and handed out gifts to childhood friends and relatives who arrived to meet her. In case you are desperate for the details, and again, everyone in Israel knows everything about everybody, last Thursday, she ordered breakfast in her room before visiting Jerusalem's Machane Yehuda Market and the Western Wall, where she placed a note. No word yet on who stole the note and what she prayed for. No doubt the Oscar-winning actress for Black Swan, opposite another Jewish actress, Mila Kunis, will visit Israel again soon. And by the way, when is Natalie Portman going to go ahead and marry that French guy who has fathered her child already?
Hooray for Hollywood, that phony super coney Hollywood.
In Italy, Jerzy Kluger, the Polish-born Jew who was a lifelong friend of the late Pope John Paul II, has died in Rome at the age of 90. The Rome Jewish community said his funeral took place last week. He was buried in the city's Jewish cemetery. Like John Paul, born Karol Wojtyła, Kluger was born in the southern Polish town of Wadowice. He was a year younger than the future Pope, but the two were boyhood playmates and shared school benches together. Kluger was known by his nickname Jurek and Wojtyła by his nickname Lolek. Most of Kluger's family was killed in the Holocaust. He and Wojtyla remained in touch over the years, and the two men's friendship is believed to have influenced Pope John Paul II's thinking on Jews. John Paul, who died in 2005, made improving Catholic-Jewish relations a hallmark of his papacy.
Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly.
And Yaffa Yarkoni, one of Israel's greatest and best-beloved singers, passed away January 1st, New Year's Day in Tel Aviv at the age of 86, following a battle with Alzheimer's disease. Lyricist Avi Koren, a close friend of the singer's for 45 years, recalled that Yarkoni, an Israel Prize laureate, once said to him, "Look how I am fooling the entire world. After all, I have no voice." If you want to hear an incredibly moving piece, listen again to Yaffa Yarkoni singing Bab El Wad, the song of the War of Liberation. She may not have had a spectacular voice, but it was unbelievably moving. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Ben-Tzion Kravitz. He's the founder of Jews for Judaism and the executive director of the Los Angeles branch, the group that works to rescue, might not be too strong a word, Jews who have been taken in by cults, have been kind of coercively or perhaps more seductively taken by missionaries. He has worked all over the world and spoken everywhere. And he's the winner of the 2011 Kohan Foundation Award for service to Klal Yisrael, really in the area of rescue. So we talked a little about what a cult is and the appeal that cults make. You identified one that I think many of our listeners might not think of as a cult, the Kabbalah Center. Without going into too great a depth, explain what makes something a cult.
You know, a lot of people have struggled with that definition, especially when you're dealing with people that join normative, you know, mainline religious groups,
right,
that may differ than your particular cultural background or faith. So I think the line in the sand, so to speak, that clarifies it is that cults differ from legitimate religions because cults endorse and utilize deception in order to recruit people and keep them in their group. And they also utilize manipulation. And I think any legitimate religion, whether we agree with it theologically or not, would never condone deception or manipulation. And I think that's the real issue for me that distinguishes a cult from a legitimate religion.
As soon as your religion starts asking for the majority of your income, that's probably a good sign that it's a cult?
Well, I think it's more than just asking for the amount of your income. It's how it asks for your income. Is it telling you this is the only place to give, and if you give somewhere else, something bad might happen to you, and that this is the only ticket to heaven, as was used to be the slogan in the Moonies in the 60s. That was their slogan. The Moonies said a ticket to heaven, or heavenly deception, they called it. The Hare Krishnas called it transcendental trickery. As a way that it's okay. It's they you know, the ends justify the means. Well, I don't think that that's true. I don't think we should ever believe that the ends justify the means.
Let's shift to missionaries and the missionary approach. When you guys started, there was a directed push and well-funded to try to convert Jews to Christianity for sometimes evangelical reasons. Well, obviously evangelical reasons, but for messianic reasons and for others. There are a variety of messianic groups that do still target Jews. They're not, I think their profile is lower than it used to be, but maybe you can talk about what the reality is today.
I think the profile has evolved. In the 70s, early 70s, the whole message that you could be Jewish and Christian simultaneously was a very fresh idea. It was very shocking. And when people heard the term Jew for Jesus, the average Jewish person kind of cringed. And even in the church, the average Gentile Christian saw that as somewhat bizarre and strange. The success, unfortunately for the Jewish community, of Jews for Jesus has been that they have made that mantra that you can be Jewish and Christian simultaneously, they've made it the norm. They've made it acceptable. we've always looked at it as like, you know, kosher pork.
Yeah.
Mixing the two opposites. But the longer they've perpetuated that, the more it has become accepted, where you could go into a Southern Baptist church in the middle of nowhere, where there are very few Jews living there, and they would meet a Jew, and they would immediately tell the Jew, of course you can be Jewish and Christian at the same time. Well, 40 years ago, they wouldn't have said that. It would have been out of the ordinary. So that's where it's really evolved, that the whole movement has grown. The numbers have grown. Their presentation of being a quote, a fifth branch of Judaism, where, interestingly, I think this is the one fundamental issue where Reconstructionist, conservative, reform, Orthodox, Hasidic Jews all are united in absolute agreement that once a Jewish person accepts the divinity of Jesus, the belief in the Trinity, and the belief in the Messiahship of Jesus, that that is a Christian belief, not a Jewish belief.
Right.
And they wanted to make it sound like it is the only correct Jewish belief, and that all the other denominations are wrong. So they're trying to redefine Judaism with that twist that they perpetuated.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been an interesting explanation. Jews for Jesus are just Christians. It's not very complicated. It's nothing pejorative about Christians. They're not Jews anymore.
I say they're evangelical Christians masquerading as Orthodox Jews.
I heard once that the amount of money it took Jews for Jesus to convert one Jew was something like $80,000 or $90,000 per Jew. Don't know if that's accurate, but the organization still exists. It's still fairly heavily funded, although from different sources than it may have been originally. Is it still having some, for want of a better term, success?
Well, I think the whole overall movement, which includes groups like Jews for Jesus, Chosen People Ministries, Assemblies of God, churches have an outreach to Jewish people, the Southern Baptists have an outreach. But just to give you a sample of how it's grown, in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel today, it is estimated that there are 20,000 Israelis who now consider themselves believers in Jesus. They do not call him Jesus. They use a Hebrew name, Yeshua, and they call themselves Yehudim Meshichim, Messianic Jews. But even the thought that there's 20,000, Jews for Jesus has an office in Tel Aviv with at least five families, some of whom are Sabras who've accepted Christianity. Now, in my research, I found that most of them knew very, very little about Judaism. And which shocks a lot of people because they figure if you're Israeli, you learn a lot about Judaism. But it's not necessarily true. They learn a lot of history. But in the Israeli public school system, theology and religion is not taught, as we might assume.
Right. I mean, in a secular, in a Chiloni school, you're going to get Tanakh as history. And
absolutely,
that's pretty much it. Let's talk a little bit about methodology. You get a call, or you talk to a parent who comes up to you at a lecture you're giving, or somebody sends you an email and they say, my son, my daughter has been approached by Fellowship of Christian Athletes or has been invited to be part of it, and they're now carrying a Bible with them, and it's not the Jewish Bible, and I don't know what to do. What happens?
Well, when they call me, the first thing I recognize is they are not the they are equally in need of help as their child. They're going through a crisis also in how to cope with this whole problem. So I look at the entire family as a unit and how to help them. So the first thing I do is I try to counsel the family. What kind of communication is going on? What kind of communication is going on in the family? What kind of issues are going on? How can I help with their communication skills with their child? I do an evaluation of the family history to try to get a better understanding. Then we talk about ways to open up communication either between them and their child, or even to introduce me into the situation and how to talk to him, to do it in a non-threatening way, to build rapport and talk about things that we have in common, to be available in a non-threatening way to answer questions. And slowly, it builds into a relationship where the person I'm talking to trusts me as someone that they can turn to as much as they might turn to anyone else. And for the first time, in most of these cases, this may be the only person that they've turned to as an adult. You know, they went to Hebrew school, but they were a child. But now they're an adult, and this is the first time in their adult life that they're really talking to someone within the Jewish community. Because I'm sure you're as aware as anyone else that at a certain point in age, when kids go through Jewish schools, that the drop-off rate increases as they get older. And then there's a period where they're not involved in anything. And they become Jews for nothing.
Right.
So now is the first time that they're seeing someone. And it has to be done with a lot of love. They've got to see that we're not angry at them, that that we care about them, and that we have answers to their questions, their theological questions. They ask about Isaiah 53, Isaiah 7:14. We have to be able to explain it and to not be afraid of these kinds of questions.
It's very interesting because, in essence, it's really almost it's a positive approach. It's a therapeutic approach, in a way. Develop trust before you begin to address those issues. And, you know, almost have to do you let them lead in addressing the issues once you've built a level of trust with the individual?
Absolutely. I want them to uncover the issues. I want them to bring the questions out. I want them to relearn who they are. And I want to be simply a guide, someone who's available to help them. So occasionally there'll be times where, you know, I might ask a probing question to ask them what they think about. You know, it depends on the circumstance. Sometimes they're not coming through a counseling session, something like that. Sometimes you're meeting someone on the street who's being proselytized. I was in Israel this summer for a number of weeks, and I was on Ben Yehuda Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a missionary proselytizing two young Jewish girls. And they were terrified. You could see that they were shaking, and they felt trapped. They couldn't walk away. And I went over and I was listening, and the missionary said, would you like to add something? So I said, you know what? I think you're saying some pretty amazing things. You know what? I believe that, you know, God had a relationship with a woman and gave birth to a child that was God in the body and superhuman and came to save the world. He says, really? What's his name? I said, Hercules. So he said, no, it can't be Sir Hercules. I said, why not? Well, he was a myth.
Oh. Well.
So I said, what kind of myth? He said, a Greek myth. I said, what language was the New Testament written in? And he said, Greek. And I said, I'm not trying to accuse what you believe in, but I'm trying to give you an opportunity to think out of the box.
Fascinating. The best way for people to find out more about Jews for Judaism, the best way for people to reach you, tell us.
Absolutely, the best way is to go on the internet. Go to our website, spelt out completely, Jews for Judaism.
That's F-O-R, right?
F-O-R, spelt that, jewsforjudaism.org. And we have several offices. We have one in California, one in Baltimore, one in Toronto, and we have part-time office in Sydney, Australia, and one in Johannesburg, South Africa. And all of our information's up on the website. There are thousands, literally thousands of pages of information for download. Free literature and podcasts on our website, and you can contact us for free counseling. And we're here to help the community in any way we can.
I want to thank Rabbi Benson Kravitz for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Jews for Judaism continues to work in counteracting cults and missionizing against of Jews to other religious traditions. And please find out more. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much also.
Again, the Kohan Foundation Award winner for 2011, very well deserving. You can find out more about the Kohan Foundation by going to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com. Thanks very much. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock when our guest will be Melanie Netzer, the Senior Policy Director for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, HIAS. Our playout this morning comes from Chazan David Propus, a setting of Oseh Shalom. May God, who makes peace in the heavens, make peace for us. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Oseh Shalom bimromam, hu ya'aseh shalom aleinu. Oseh Shalom bimromam, hu ya'aseh shalom aleinu. Shalom aleinu, yaseh shalom, yaseh shalom, shalom aleinu, v'al kol Yisrael, yaseh shalom, yaseh shalom, shalom.